You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 22nd of June, 2022. Again, I invite everyone to, if you haven't done so already, to join my Patreon. And I know I'm awful at responding to letters and requests and messages. That's usually nothing personal, but there is simply too many, and but I do need to improve on that in the future. Good news here is that I have a new line of merchandise coming out on the 1st of July. I think Tsar Nicholas is going to be the theme. And these are going to continue to, you know, change and develop as time goes on, designed by different people. Someone sent in a design that said Philetist on it, had a Gaelic cross, which I may do. If you don't know what I'm talking about there, you can go back to the first lecture I ever gave on Radio Albion back in 2016 on the myth of the Synod of Constantinople in 1872 on that topic. In fact, I have two fairly lengthy articles on that. It's completely original. No one's ever argued it before, at least not in English. And that's been one of my favorites so far. I may just do something with that. But I have stuff from the Union of the Russian People. I have, you know, all kinds of, you know, czarist symbols, and not just in Russia either. So I have almost an infinity of ideas. But if anything strikes you, please let me know. The email, the Orthodox Nationalist Gmail, it should be used for that kind of stuff, for the merchandising. I got a few things in the mail from the company a few days ago, and they're very high quality, and I'm extremely, extremely pleased with them. Again, I keep fielding questions about the nominalism book. The heavy lifting is finished. I still am mulling over various publishers and what to do with it. I know wherever it goes, it's going to sell. I want to do this before anyone else does, because I started this huge interest in the topic years ago, and people are touching on it, but not getting into it in any depth. So I want to make sure this is out very soon. Essentially, it's the Church Fathers as metaphysicians, not so much as theologians, and there is a distinction there. They were philosophers and ontologists of the first rank, and then, of course, they're never... the problem is that people who are knowledgeable in them as theologians often aren't knowledgeable concerning metaphysics. They don't really know the language. And people who know the metaphysics usually skip over them entirely. You know, it goes from, you know, they'll throw in something on Augustine, and they won't revisit this now until maybe William of Ockham or even Hobbes. It's a common error. That entire part of philosophical history is very conveniently, even by classicists and Platonists, completely ignored. Christianity is inherently Platonic. Nothing makes any sense about church doctrine without the basic idea of the forms. Many church fathers have referred to themselves as Platonists straight out, like Justin Martyr. However, there are several uses of that term that confuse more benighted people. Platonism could also mean the post-Platonic or Neoplatonic occult and arcane sciences, which Plato never dabbled in. There was simply not the concept of it at the time. Certainly, but if there were, he fought it. And sometimes when you see these condemnations of it, that's what they're referring to. It's a different definition entirely. It's misleading, and it shouldn't have been. But that's what, the doctrine of ideas eventually decayed entirely into the slogan, as above, so below. And as always, it's a perversion. You know, that's what demonism is. Demonism is a perversion of the natural order. And this belief that soul and body have nothing to do with each other, even to the point of totally denying the soul or denying the body, one of the two, that matter is autonomous, is just a meat suit that people wear and can be switched with any soul or any identity, and they have nothing to do with each other. And we're going to be talking about this today, something I haven't done. I find, and I've been working on, dozens of Orthodox philosophers in the past who no one really knows much about. When I first got started, finding good English language material on some of these guys was very difficult. Now, that's all changed. In the last 20 years, you've had a flood of sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes mediocre articles and books on the topic. And they filled in a lot of gaps, because Western philosophy today is pretty worthless. It's really just word games and trying to create questions for the scientific establishment, which is some of the analytics. That's all they say. It's worthless, and they really don't. Most philosophy departments provide nothing to the world, and shouldn't be there. UNLV abolished its entire department. They really do produce nothing. So these guys tend to fill in these gaps very well. And who I'm talking about today is Pamphil Yurkevich, who for a long time you couldn't find much about him. Even today, of all people, he's probably the least, I don't think anything has been translated that I know of into English. He was born 1827. He died in 1874. So he didn't have a long life. And he is what most will say is a representative of the Kiev school, or the Caves, of philosophical ontologism. He was a professor at the Kiev Theological Academy, which is pretty much the highest you can go in the Slavic world. And then later became a philosophy professor at Moscow University, and distinguished himself as being the first real teacher of Vladimir Soloviev. And Soloviev went a completely different way. Again, he is someone that there used to be almost nothing about. Now you find him, he was fashionable for a while because they could treat him in a Gnostic way. But Yurkevich was a student of the Archimandrite Theophanes Arseniev. Received his doctoral degree in 1854, and he also taught German, which was not uncommon. People like Kente Gazel and others were of German background. So that's his background. And what happened in the rest of the 19th century was the development of this sort of Neoplatonic idea, and how it's very closely connected with theology. Theology, of course, has to have a philosophical component, because it has to be grounded in something. There has to be a connection between God and man, between God and the natural order. That's almost just an elementary idea that no one could ever deny. So if thought is a part of the natural order, then so are ideas. Evil is the perversion of these, or the literal definition is to turn away, meaning to turn away from something, that is to say, reality. In Russia at the time, Tsar Nicholas I, Alexander II, materialism and what was called nihilism, now that has to be defined here, were very fashionable. Of course, being financed entirely by the West, that developed in the cities to justify the commercial economy. Now, materialism and nihilism are, they come across as absolutes, but they're not. No one can consistently be a materialist, because that way you could never blame anyone for their actions. But Yurkevich begins this by saying that this is really the product of laziness. It's this prosaic accumulation. It's a way to reduce everything. To reduce everything to a very basic, simplistic foundation. But if everything is material, then there's no real distinguishing aspect of things. There's only one so-called essence. And in fact, it might even be a form of realism. There's no distinction between subject and object in this case. The word association and the association of concepts in the mind are completely arbitrary. There's no difference between the observer and the observed if everything deep down is simply one thing. This is an extreme form of monism that is almost self-refuting. And he debated Chernyshevsky, who was the very fashionable materialist philosopher of the day, and the debate between the two of them is certainly worth reading. But he was a Platonist, and this is a weapon that he and many other people used against the materialism of the day. Remember, materialism is that everything either is or is reducible to matter. However that's defined, and of course it was very crude at the time. Materialism can't be justified scientifically. It's a meta-scientific idea. It's an assumption. It could never be verified empirically. Because, of course, it may beg the question, but to say that everything, you know, the words everything and all are very common, but rarely can they be used intelligently. And the other aspect of the materialist idea, of course, inherently is that there can be no purpose in it. It's one of the central ideas, and E. Michael Jones has written about this concerning the Newtonian universe, having very close connections with the overthrow of the legitimate English crown and its replacement by William of Orange and the bankers of Amsterdam. And of course, it has everything to do with the writings earlier of Thomas Hobbes. This chaos on the throne, meaning the most powerful, the most wealthy faction can take over and take over by force. It's very convenient to create a cosmology. And in Newton's case, it happened at the exact same time as there was chaos and purposelessness in high places, especially in the crown. William of Orange had no right to rule. He ruled because of his power and his money built in continental Europe in the Jewish banking industry from the English, in the Cromwellian struggle. The moral purpose of the crown was completely lost and was taken over simply by a junta. And this is where this concept of purposelessness, atoms in the void, again, which can't be justified and can't be rendered in scientific language at all. But it's easy. And it justifies complete nihilism. Now, nihilism at the time, you see this in Turgenev and others, was defined as solely positivism. It's the idea that only the most basic positivist statements can ever be made concerning things that are verifiable empirically. Well, that very concept is unverifiable empirically, and it can't be replicated. The theory of evolution cannot be replicated. The theory of the ever-expanding universe can't be replicated. These are speculative ideas. However, natural law in one form or another exists. And the problem with natural law, including even the purported laws of evolution, is that they can evolve. Because there wasn't a time where there was no physics, you know, a million years ago, or the laws of photosynthesis didn't exist a million years ago. That had to be identical from the dawn of matter to today. So that begs the question, where do natural laws come from, and what do they tell us? It's not merely that organisms, very separate from one another and only reproducing of their own kind, their own form, want to survive, but they also want to thrive. And with humans, of course, the concept of thriving is, as Aristotle pointed out, is extremely complex. So to talk about purposelessness is not only non-scientific, but also very difficult to justify even logically. The very existence of natural law seems to promote the idea of survival and thriving. And that in fact creates very strong, very adaptable organisms. But beyond the sense data, you know, the positivists will talk about sense data all the time, but never really rely on it. Most of what they think is speculative. And that's the biggest problem. Only within that speculative context can they start doing their experiments. But their experiments have to be based already on their assumptions. Assumptions have to come first. There's no getting around the idea of axioms. The not only things that are unprovable, but in fact are the conditions for proof. Now, for example, the law of non-contradiction. In its very literal sense, in Aristotle's sense, not later on with Hegel. You have to assume that's true for linear logic to make any sense at all. Something cannot both be and not be in the same way, the same respect, at the same time. That's an assumption. But thought, our thinking, is different from our sensing because it presents itself to us. We talked about this with Frank a few months ago. As objective, to talk about materialism this way is to call it a universal necessity, which maintains itself still as a universal. And it's based on the idea, given the difference between senses and thought, that universal a universal necessity of materialism can transfer itself into phenomenon. That is to say, this mysterious material element that is the root of all things can, in our thought and our senses, create a three-dimensional complex object. But, of course, this can't be true. And certainly it's opposed to the very crude materialism of the day. I'm thinking of people like Basarov and Chernyshevsky and even Pavlov. But one of the central ideas here is positivism is very literal. Positivism and that type of empiricism on the one hand and poetry on the other have nothing to do with each other. In fact, they are contradictory. The concept of poetry, and I'm kind of interpolating here, is that words don't mean the term itself or even the thought itself. Doesn't exhaust its content. Poetry uses words in a very eccentric way because words aren't only their literal denotation. There's also a connotation, and that connotation is connected with everything else and is bounded by space and time. But it's still far richer than the literal denotation. So when someone wants to criticize the use of a word by giving its dictionary definition, they probably don't know what they're talking about. Words, unfortunately, can be defined many different ways, and that changes over time. This is one of the reasons the churches, in the East and the West, wanted to maintain the old languages. You can't have a living language for basic church doctrine because words change their definition. Even in one of the Orthodox prayers, it says God is fire by nature. This is in one of the post-communion prayers. Well, that's not a literal thing. There's not a fire burning in heaven. It's a symbolic concept of what fire happens to be. This creative activity, you know, it creates and destroys for the sake of the good. you know, it's also very rational. The concept of the sun and gold, it's an ancient symbol for these very good things. But, and the original term preserves that. This is why the Church of Rome maintained Latin up until 50 years ago, where Church Slavonic and the older style Greek was maintained for a very long time. Now, it's not to say that you can't communicate with people using that language. It's not really meant for that. Old Slavonic is inherently a liturgical language. But because words are changing, that there's a difference between their denotation and connotation, is why these languages had to be maintained. And as difficult of a decision as that is. And this was also the problem with the Old Believers. They said, you know, you're using terms that either have a denotation or a connotation that's very negative. They took this very seriously because words are icons. And many years ago, in my book on Russian literature, I talk about this with Nikolai Gogol to a great extent. Words are icons, and the definition can never exhaust what that word really is. And hence, that's what poetry, and in fact, that's what music is. All of our representations, these things that we perceive, contain a pretty substantial residual that goes beyond any system of thinking or any system of ideas. In fact, are there any concept of the whole? The concept of the whole itself can't be perceived. It's assumed, however, in every thought and every sense that we have. Just like words, same thing for thoughts, and the two are very, very closely related. A term, like I said, like fire in the North, isn't exhausted by whatever definition we happen to use for it. Even the older, more expansive definition doesn't exhaust the concept. Any, not just our thoughts, but the phenomenon that we can perceive are connected. They're, first of all, their origin is very complex. Any object, I don't care how simple it is, anything you're perceiving or hearing has an extraordinarily long origin story. It's then connected with everything else in a purely natural way, not to mention in a cultural and religious way, and then in the way of philosophy and science and everything else. One simple object is connected with everything else in the most extraordinary way that resists all. I mean, we could write for the rest of our history and never exhaust it all. And in fact, that's what science is supposed to be, connecting all of these things. That's the older definition, the Aristotelian definition of science, or any coherent field put together under rational axioms. And this is the foundation of apophatic thought, which is so central to the Hesychast. That any time we take, even the words we use in prayer, these, again, don't exhaust the subject matter. We could talk about the concept of fire in that context for days and days and days. When we use it, or when we perceive it in one form or another, that doesn't take all of that into consideration. We have a kind of an abbreviation. It's to some extent, this is a simple example, but the difference between a cookbook and a master chef. What the master chef does can't be entirely captured in the cookbook. In fact, this was Michael Oakeshott. I did my dissertation on this. Michael Oakeshott's example of this very same idea, being a British, a later British Hegelian. And the source of this knowledge, the origin of this knowledge, as far as we're concerned, comes from the heart. This is also a hesychastic term. And this is in the middle of that revival in Russia. The heart is something that can accept and understand the apophatic. It's the psychic center. It isn't, however, the soul. It's the unity of the soul and everything else. It's the center of all action, the origin of our action. In other words, thought can't be reduced to mere cognition, which also comes from apophatic logic. And the heart is not something that can be, these things can't be operationalized. None of these things can be reduced to a set of numbers or even a set of words that everyone agrees on the definition. And at numbers that can be put into a computer. The positivist ideal insists that that's the case. And so much of modernity, not so much postmodernity, but modernity is based on that myth. So in his debate with Chernyshevsky, he makes the point that our inner life, in other words, psychic life, that derives from the heart, is not amenable to what he called scientific realism. It is not bound by time and space. Psychic life, one thought doesn't follow from the other necessarily. And in fact, if it does, we have to force ourselves to do it. And we talked about this also with Simon Frank, that consciousness seems to be outside of both space and time. It may be creative of it, or at least discovering it. But our thoughts, and one of the reasons that materialism is false, is that our thoughts don't follow this determined order. We could interrupt them at any given moment. Oftentimes our thoughts don't make sense. They don't follow one from another. They don't go from simple association to simple association. And even if they were, our thought about something is not the same thing as the object. And even the two together don't exhaust the content of it all. So in other words, if thought somehow came from matter directly, because I suppose that even the thought has to be in some sense material in their system, it would be extremely orderly. It would have to be. The whole idea of the materialistic universe at the time and to a certain extent today is based on pure mechanism. That hypothetically, every single thing can be known if every single cause were known. Causes in their fullness, which again is a non-scientific statement. It would also imply, though, that the scientific establishment and those who fund it would have full predictive power and control over everything that exists, including our inner life. And the idiots who promote this then and now don't realize just how dangerous it is. There's a reason that the mind can't be read, except for the most simple people. The mind can't be read because thoughts don't operate according to normal mechanism. Now, it's possible for us to fall into that, to become so lazy and indolent that we don't put any effort into thinking at all, and our mind really does just become a stage on which images pass with no real purpose. But that's a perversion of what a human being is. A human being is someone who is both rational and free. Rational even in the simple sense of attaching means to ends in the most utilitarian way, reaching rational goals and laying out a plan to get there. But and that's very simple, that's very basic. But that also implies that you're free. If materialism is true, then setting goals, it doesn't make any sense. Because the association, the causal change are going to happen no matter what you do. And you know, the regime has not, over the few centuries, has not been able to rectify this. Even someone like Spinoza, who in a simple way says, well, only if we know that we're determined are we free from determination. And that's as far as they can go. That's as far as really Marx could go, because he had a purely materialistic system. And because of that, there can be no moral ideals, because ideals, by their very structure, can't be part of a materialistic system. But the very separation that we intuitively have between the inner and the outer, the psychic life on the one hand and phenomenon that we perceive on the other hand, shows that that there is this, that the forms are separated from the world. I'm talking about in Plato's sense, that there's an essence that is separate from the manifestation, or the hypostasis, for lack of a better term. Now, he lays out in this regard. I don't want to bend, but you know, I've always been I see a lot of wisdom in Spinoza. I've never done a lecture on him, but I've read everything. But there is that idea, because even Spinoza, in a very simplistic way, is interpreted as a pure determinist. And somehow freedom is to be found in the fact that we know and understand the causes of our actions, despite the fact that we're not the author of those actions. Somehow self-awareness can fit into a materialistic system. And this is why you get, not to mention the moral issue of blame. If there is no freedom, if everything is mechanism, there's no freedom, then the phenomenon of freedom doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The fact that we're conscious of it, that we can actually perceive it. When we talked about artificial intelligence as being based in the idea that freedom is a myth, and that the brain, the minds don't exist, the brain is merely a computer and function the exact same way. So they load the debate. They already assume that the brain is a computer, therefore artificial intelligence is the same as humanity. And how very few people can even comprehend that they're loading. So there are three different realms of thought. Many years ago, we talked about Scovarota, who, if I had to pick one person who typifies what I think about the world, at least metaphysically, it's him. And Scovarota, of course, is quite a bit before Yurkevich. There's three realms, and it shouldn't surprise anybody who knows Plato. And the first is the uncreated. This is Logos. Logos is the foundation of everything, including logic itself. Of course, the word has been abused recently, but it's the forms of creation. Logos is a part of it. The Trinity created the world, not just God the Father. That's why there's a plural for God. It's a great proof of the Trinity. The pattern exists prior, not chronologically, but prior to the actual manifestation. And that's what Logos is. Logos is a collection of all the forms and archetypes of creation. Knowledge is defined as reaching those. But to reach those, you have to live an ascetic life to be not subject to the accidental qualities of things, which tends to distract us. So the forms, the archetypes of all things, which are eternal, are to be found in Logos and are the root of all creation, the root of all reason, the root of freedom, the root of everything, and they are non-material. They can't be material, because if they were, they would change. The only thing that could never change is something that's immaterial. When St. Augustine uses the term number, this is the case with even Plato too, in the whole Platonic school. Remember, numbers aren't numerals. They're icons, especially the difference between one and two, between unity and multiplicity. Losev talks about this as well. The whole has to come before the parts, or else they're not parts. And that's what the number one is. This is what numbers are. They're qualitative measures. Now, the second thing is our contribution. Our reason connected to forms. This is what knowledge is. We discover things. We don't invent things. And there has to be a preloaded a structure in our minds that can connect to these things. The minute you start talking about the meaning of mathematics, you're talking about immaterial truth. Even if you consider number as a quantitative thing, you realize without question that it doesn't change. It's not, it can be substantiated in matter, but isn't itself material. We use numbers with the assumption that they're outside of material things. And both Losev and St. Augustine and so many others base the argument simply is that the truths that we know and understand, the most basic axiomatic truths, aren't material. Okay, so then what is the origin of these things? And that's how we climb from the passions, from the drives to become wealthy or powerful or whatever, which never works out, to not so much worry about that, but about the truth of the matter, which is very different. Things like money and power are accretions. They're always defined in conventional terms. No, we're talking about the foundations of the natural order. So this second realm is almost a realm of struggle. Freedom can only be achieved through the immaterial forms. If something is material, then it must have parts and must be entirely determined. That means truth can't be material, and our lives can't be based on it. There is neither freedom nor reason. You can't have reason, and reason implies freedom. Free will is not something that we're born with. Free will is something we have to struggle for, and it's extremely difficult. to reach free will, because you can't allow heterodimous elements, you know, like money and your reputation and these self-imposed limits, cannot affect your apprehension of the truth. For the most part, I mean, I never found truth to be particularly difficult to reach on something. What makes it difficult is that most people don't want to reach it. There are psychological barriers, because if I realize that my life is based on irrationality, I'm going to be very upset. People tend to justify what already is because it's easy. And of course, the regime, or way in the regime, is a part of every philosophical discussion, creates pre-approved rebellious channels. So that's the second realm. And the third realm, this is very common in the Kiev Academy and the theology of the day, is phenomenon. There's a distinction between phenomenon, which is the actual concrete event, whatever it might be, the object we see, hear, or smell, doesn't matter. This is what affects the senses. Phenomenon can be real, or it can be projected. This is the realm of illusion, at least in the sense that it's not necessary to come to truth, something that has to be overcome. An illusion is simply something that may or may not be projected onto the world. So senses, then, would be based on some phenomenon, or based on some kind of mechanism, at least at the material level. But the difference between phenomenon on the one hand and noumenon on the other, or the origin of, the source of the phenomenon, that's what the noumenon is, and that is never material. So, a materialist claim, and we've already touched on this, which existed in a very crude form at the time, is that somehow our perceptions are created by neurons firing. And I don't think people fully understand what that means even today. But the argument then, that somehow consciousness is in any way a scientific topic, that somehow the spatial firing of neurons can be translated into thought in space and time, or spatial thought, temporal thought, which doesn't make any sense. Whether we, our thoughts and our perceptions are done in very complex ways that can't be reduced to electrical firings, because you still have to explain how those firings can create three-dimensional images, either in thought or in perception. So the phenomenon are these images that can be created by falsehood but can't be fully explained. It's kind of like saying that we drive a car, we go from point A to point B. The reason we go from point A to point B is gas or internal combustion or the rubber tires. Those are secondary phenomena. That's not the reason people want to reduce, you know, the feeling of love is chemical. No, the chemical occurs at the same time as the feelings of love. It's kind of like saying in baseball, a home run is caused by the numbers on the screen, or the numbers on the scoreboard. These kind of very simple reductionist statements, these are really common among the pseudo-intellectuals. This is, you know, the cocktail party talk. This is intellectual small talk, so to speak. So any object, any X, any sensible that we happen to see is a collection of qualities. But of course, it can't be just that. Any object that we may see doesn't seem to be a unity in and of itself. It becomes a unity only through thought. But thought isn't something outside of the natural order. The nominalists and the positivists think that's true, that these are just abstractions that are, you know, conventional and don't exist in nature at all, which doesn't make any sense, especially if you're materialist. They all have to be connected with it. But thought is a part of the natural order, no different than our skin or our heart is. Then the unity of any object has to be so in nature too. If you're going to claim that these are mechanical unities, to the extent that mechanism can even create it, I mean, mechanism is unity in and of itself, You can't talk about freedom, you can't talk about reason, and you most certainly can't talk about ethics. So the concept of a true phenomenon, one that isn't based on illusion, is that you have an object, there is a form of that object in our mind that's receptive of the it can be receptive to the archetype outside, that somehow it can connect to the intellectual context of whatever we're talking about, this truth that doesn't change. And that natural objects often have a social background, but that doesn't mean that they're conventional. One way to consider it, and this is kind of the metaphor that I've used in the past, is that objects are formed by ecosystems. This is connected with the idea that a term or a phenomenon can never exhaust itself. There's an infinite content, and we only are aware of, or can be aware of, a minuscule portion of it. An ecosystem, of course, is this realm of mutual dependency. The easiest example would be our own body. Hearts, lungs, circulatory, the electrical system, the nervous system, the spine, muscles, everything, you know, has to work together at the same time, let alone the genetic code, which, of course, destroys evolution entirely. You know, genetic code has billions and billions of mutually dependent objects and forces. The tiniest lack of equilibrium among them will destroy it, and life would be absolutely impossible. That's your concept of an equilibrium. That's your concept of an ecosystem. So if you want to talk about, let's say, the organ of the human lung or the human liver, they only make sense within the human body. You take a lung, I think I've said this before, you take a lung or the liver or the heart and you hold it in your hand, it's no longer a lung. It's just a useless hunk of matter. It's only a lung when it's a part of the context of the human body. And that's how it works for any object. Everything is based on a context, both cultural and intellectual. And that's how we come to know it. That's how the unities of these things come together. Now, the utilitarian will say that that's merely just a matter of whatever is easiest, but that implies that convention controls everything, which, again, is not exactly a scientific concept. Our mind contains the non-physical elements of this, and he uses the example of a circle or equality. These are things that exist in the mind primarily. They're still part of the natural order, but they exist separately from material objects. Material objects can be equal to one another. They can be circular. But the concept of a circle or equality is something that's purely noumenal, not phenomenal. They're not of the same order, however, as the phenomenon that they might manifest. They sense it as a form. Or we sense it as a form. An archetype, which is greater, which is another way of saying more fundamental than its manifestation in the natural order. But the circle or the concept of equality, even the concept of seven or anything like that, that can't be a subjective matter. Because the ideal and the real here can never be reconciled. The concept of a perfect circle, or even perfection itself, exists prior to any perception of it in the natural order. And this is part of the reason why materialism is so false. The concepts of truth and falsehood are impossible, and this argument is a very common one, that in a system of materialism, which by definition is pure determinism, there's no way of knowing, as I said before, inner, outer, or certainly no way of knowing the difference between truth and falsehood. You can't make those claims in a materialistic system. All you know and what you think may be a logical design that's irrefutable, this is nothing more than associations being caused A, B, C, D, and E. There's no truth value there because there's no freedom or reason there. It may be presented that way, But if you already deny the existence of reason, and you have to, illogic may exist. But if you deny the existence of reason, you can't talk about truth or falsehood. All you can say is that this is the mechanical result of X, not whether it's true or false, but it's just the inevitable result. Concepts of reason and true and false and good and evil imply freedom. Materialism also, as he says to Chernyshevsky, can't progress. There's only so much matter in the world, and the only thing you can do is rearrange it. This is the purpose of the great architect of creation. He doesn't produce anything. The demiurge doesn't produce anything. The architect, the assumption of the architect in masonry is that he is not creative of matter. He may convince people he is. Satan is always trying to convince people that he is the equal to God, and they're fighting it out eternally in the world. But the truth is, of course, is that Satan is a creation of God and uses the evil for a greater good in the future, which is the case. I mean, evil doesn't have any substance, so ultimately all it can do is force us to be harder and smarter, because that's what's, you know, that's the purpose you could find in the natural order, even at an absolute minimum. Man doesn't act in terms of abstraction. He doesn't act in terms of determinism, at least man at his best. He acts via consciousness and freedom. Otherwise, you can't even talk about the word act. Our whole language is based around the assumption that people act freely. Now, the concept of utilitarianism, I remember when he's writing here as another fad at the time, utility trying to do away with truth and falsehood, tried to do away with freedom, tried to do away with any ideal conception at all. Utilitarianism is based on the idea that people act, you know, if you would use the ethical term good, and they mean that in a very specific way, not in our way, but good is simply the productive of greater pleasure than there was before. What most human beings conceive of as pleasurable is the reason why we act. A society is better than another, more progressive than another, is smarter than another, because it's productive of more pleasure. And that's pleasure in a very, very broad sense. The problem with utilitarianism, and I was in grad school and I made this point, it really is a stupid theory, because there is nothing that we can do. I'm not talking about the mentally ill. I mean, people creating suffering for themselves is actually very common, but we're talking about a healthier society. Everything we do is self-regarding. It's such an ambiguous idea. It's this non-congruent. There's no commensurable motive and results. Everything we do can be based on some kind of utilitarianism. This is the reason why we act at all. And it's almost as if sin is inherent in every single act we commit in the phenomenal realm, because it's always self-regarding. Even asceticism can be seen as self-regarding if you have a belief system that justifies it. So utilitarianism is a very poor substitute. There was this battle. I mean, Adam Smith was a utilitarian. John Locke was not. You know, the old slogan is that if, you know, the greatest happiness or the greatest number, productive of pleasure in there, is the foundation of everything, then if you have five sick people, each has a different organ of their body that's failing, you could kill one person and put all of his organs into the sick people. So now you'll have far more pleasure than you did before. So you have one dead guy, but you have five, six, seven people who now have a new lease on life. Utilitarianism has a lot of trouble with that, because that would be productive of more pleasure than existed before. And the price of one life, that doesn't make any difference, because it's enhanced now or made possible five more. And you can think of 1,000 examples like that. Utilitarianism is what at the foundation of this golden billion, this occult doctrine of the big foundations in the West that says that that's the optimal number of people that should be permitted to live on the planet. And it's commenting. It's you know, pretty much official leftist dogma for some vague environmental reason. Environmentalism has been a justification for this. Environmentalism is the ultimate utilitarianism. But ultimately, that claim is absurd. And it's like so many of these things, it has a prima facie intelligibility to it and sense to it. But in reality, of course, it would justify the killing of one person to live, make five live. Because there are no ideals, there's no concept of sacredness. And pleasure is always changing. And we all don't define this in the same way. And it's really a terrible substitute. But with utilitarianism, and this is what the free market is based on, this is the nature of Adam Smith's concept of the market and perfect competition. Abstract rights don't explain everything. Markets exist because greater good is created, and good meaning pleasure, is created in the market system than without it. But even like so many of people in this movement want to talk about self-interest, which both utilitarianism and liberalism are based on. And we live in an age now where both are collapsing into each other. John Stuart Mill was trying to maintain both at the same time. If our acts are based on our self-interest, which is very typical of market ideology and Western liberalism in general, then how does the scientific establishment escape that? If our actions are inherently self-regarding in the sense that we're only pursuing our own interests, that interest is usually defined financially, but it could also be things like reputation and power and whatever, sex, all that stuff. The passions that come from qualities rather than the essences of things. And that's how we're functioning. Then why would science be based on something else? Somehow the scientific establishment wants to accept itself. It's like the notion of deconstruction. Deconstruction can be used on the enemies of the left, but they're far more easy to deconstruct than anyone else is. Their view of our point of view, their view of the national and the Christian world is largely based on caricature. And this is what they're trying to deconstruct. But when it's done to them, all of a sudden they get very upset. In other words, they accept themselves. They're not subject to their own ideology. Everyone else is. And that's very typical of the left in general. But even like words don't exhaust their content, our psychic acts don't exhaust the self. The self is not reducible, as some of the early psychologists said. They're not reducible to psychic acts. There's something far deeper than that, and that's the origin of the will. The will is not from thought. The will starts in the heart. The heart is one of the most ambiguous terms, not only in the Western world, but worldwide. It's used all the time. Someone says, my friend here has a lot of heart. It's rare that you could find anyone who knows what you're talking about. The Western veneration of the sacred or the immaculate hearts. I've never come across a full definition of what this heart is. I mean, obviously it's not the organ. It's not like the immaculate foot or anything like that. It's got to be something deeper than that. It's very rare to try to find a full definition, at least a beginning of a definition. But the error of nominalism is that it assumes that the self can be reduced entirely to its acts, whether it be internal psychic acts or external acts, acts done in the world. And of course, positivism has to be nominal by definition. But the only thing you can do, any of these ideologies that Yurkevich is fighting, doing battle with, it could only explain formal properties, external knowledge, the practical day-to-day laws that govern interaction, but without knowing their purpose. The understanding of phenomena, and the state of mind that understands what is known, that is also not subject to formal analysis. Numbers as numerals rather than icons, what we call the operationalization of information. Well, positivism says that everything can be reduced to these very formal terms, and that's the definition of knowledge. And yet, there's an entire qualitative realm that they admit, but to them is completely nonsense. There's a connection between the mind that knows something and the thing that is known. There has to be a third thing. There has to be a fundament that connects the two. It's not an arbitrary connection, or else there's no knowledge at all. But this kind of arbitrariness, this definitely comes from the Newtonian world. Atoms in the void, atheism is built right into it. But the heart, like the will that it produces, it's our true self. This was both a Russian and a Ukrainian philosophical idea for a very long time. And they added even more content to it than their previous Hesychast on Athos. The heart is the true self, and it can't be reducible to formal qualities or formal rules. Rules really are circular. They're self-referential. It is the ground, the reason, the foundation, and will, of course, is its product. To say something is from the heart is to say something that isn't from calculation. It isn't from crude self-interest, and self-interest is generally very crude anyway, but from a genuine holistic feeling, not just of yours, but of the good of society as a whole. Sometimes when someone says, I'm saying this from the heart, they're really saying, I'm finally telling you the truth. Laws governing this kind of activity can't be, as I said before, can't be the reason for it. Gravity is not the cause of things falling. We make things fall. We want things to fall. Gravity isn't the cause of it. It's a parallel to it. It's not even an explanation. It can only be a piece of it. So what Yurkevich comes down to in his various debates over the concept of materialism, which is so essential, especially in the era, is that the laws of nature imply a supernatural origin. Because a law, by its very structure, is not something that can change. If natural laws can change, then science could never talk about something that happened millennia ago. They have no idea when these laws came into existence. The entire assumption of the evolutionary scheme is that there's one set of natural laws, very simple set of natural laws, that goes back to the very dawn of matter. Therefore, they have never evolved. These laws themselves are spiritual entities. And it's an excellent argument for the spiritual world. The minute you can establish either the origin of natural laws or the origin of reason or freedom, you can't even talk about freedom without talking about the spiritual, because something mechanical can't be free. You then ask the question, well, where did it come from then? Because a spirit is the only thing that can create a spirit. But a spirit, a reality that is, or a force that is non-material, grace, for example, is a classic example, has to be created by something superior to it. So there's a creator, and far greater than even the most sweeping and powerful natural laws. Laws somehow are seen as inherent in objects rather than something that's added to them. But that also is unexplained. The laws of nature imply purpose. They imply a supernatural origin. They imply eternity. They imply the spiritual realm. This is an argument, not the argument, but an argument for Plato's forms. There has to be these archetypes in existence that are separate from matter, because natural laws are separate from matter. If matter changes, then the law that governs them cannot change. Therefore, they're two different things. This is the core of Yurkevich's attacks on everything material, or everything that's dominated by material. And that would include the beginnings of Marxism, the nihilists, and the positivists, all who assume and imply, at least, that the only thing that exists is the material world. It's something that industrialization and also everything is the evils are based on. And it's something now, even if people claim not to be material, or even the very term has been perverted. Materialist is someone who likes a lot of luxury and cares about money. But of course, that's not the case. Someone who's like that implies that the only goods worth pursuing are those that are material. And therefore, the only things worth even talking about or understanding, the only things that are real, are a material. So the misapprehension of what the term is still implies it. This is assumed in the speech and the argument of most human beings. They'll deny that it's true, but clearly their priorities show that it's true. We live in a perverted society that puts the material things above the spiritual things and wonders why there's neurosis and depression. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.